Try Therapy Notes, the number one rated electronic health record system available today. With live telephone support 7 days a week, it's clear why Therapy Notes is rated 4.9 out of 5 stars on Trustpilot and has a 5-star rating on Google. Therapy Notes makes billing, scheduling, note-taking, and telehealth incredibly easy. And now, for all you prescribers out there, Therapy Notes is proudly introducing ePrescribe. Try it today with no strings attached and see why everyone is switching to Therapy Notes, now featuring ePrescribe. You can get 2 months free by using promo code CHAT at therapynotes.com. Trauma Therapist Network is a website to learn about trauma and how it shows up in our lives and to find a trauma therapist. Go to traumatherapistnetwork.com to find a trauma therapist near you today.
Why are so many dogs suffering with health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's been seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. After doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health, their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also supports the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. I've noticed that when I feed my dogs regular supermarket brands, they have more itchy skin, scratching their ears, behavior issues, agitation. And when I feed them healthy whole foods, superfoods, they're calmer, happier, and not having those skin issues and ear discomfort. Go to badlandsranch.com/chat and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular priced order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/chat today. Ready to take your backyard bird watching to the next level? I can't stop telling everybody about my new FeatherSnap bird feeder. It's a Wi-Fi enabled smart bird feeder, blending the best of technology and nature. I've enjoyed so much since we got this thing set up, looking up close at the birds when they land on the feeder. I get a notification to my phone with a picture. There's 3 pictures every time a bird lands on the feeder, and I get to see some cool action shots. I can see their faces close up, their eyes, their feathers, the detail on their heads. It's amazing. I've enjoyed seeing woodpeckers, goldfinches, male and female, house finches, chickadees, tufted titmouse, blue jay, a few squirrels. Check them out today at feathersnapcam.com. That's feathersnapcam.com.
Therapy Chat Podcast, episode 440.
This is the Therapy Chat Podcast with Laura Reagan, LCSWC. The information shared in this podcast is not a substitute for seeking help from a licensed mental health professional. And now, here's your host, Laura Reagan, LCSWC.
Hi, welcome back to Therapy Chat. I'm your host, Laura Reagan. Today, I'm bringing to you a conversation that I really enjoyed with Dr. Judy Ho. Dr. Judy Ho, PhD, ABPP, ABPDN, is a triple board certified and licensed clinical and forensic neuropsychologist, a tenured associate professor at Pepperdine University, and published author. She penned Stop Self-Sabotage, a book detailing a scientifically driven 6-step program which has been translated into 7 additional languages around the world. Her second book, co-authored with Max Dubrow, titled I'll Give It to You Straight-ish, What Your Teen Wants You to Know, was published in 2021 and contains Dr. Judy's evidence-based tips to help parents raise healthy and resilient teenagers. And her third book, The New Rules of Attachment, focuses on healing insecure attachment styles at any age to optimize well-being, career, goal attainment, and relationships with family, friends, and colleagues. And that book came out just this year in March 2024. Dr. Judy maintains a private practice in Manhattan Beach, California, where she specializes in comprehensive neuropsychological assessments and expert witness work. And she regularly appears as an expert psychologist on TV, podcasts, radio, and contributes to other media, including print and electronic periodicals. She was a co-host on the syndicated daytime television talk show, The Doctors, co-host of CBS's Face the Truth, and host of the Supercharged Life podcast. And that explains why she was such a polished speaker in our conversation. She's very experienced. Judy Ho is an avid researcher and two-time recipient of the National Institute of Mental Health Services Research Award. She teaches master's and doctoral level psychology students, hosts an active research program to improve mental health care for high-need populations, and is the chair of the IRB at Pepperdine University. Her treatment approaches integrate the scientific principles of CBT, ACT, and DBT. She's a sought-after keynote speaker and educator for national and local events, including research, clinical, and corporate conferences and workshops for businesses, organizations, and schools. I loved our conversation, and I hope you will too. I think that oftentimes attachment is a subject that doesn't seem clear. It doesn't seem easy to understand, but in our conversation, Judy changed that. She gave a lot of relatable information about attachment, and I hope you will enjoy it. As always, thank you for listening to Therapy Chat. Hi, welcome back to Therapy Chat. I'm your host, Laura Reagan, and today I'm so excited to be interviewing Dr. Judy Ho. Judy, thank you so much for being my guest on Therapy Chat today.
Well, thank you so much for having me on your show. I'm so excited to talk to you. I love that you do trauma therapy. I think that so many people need that, and maybe sometimes don't know it. And it takes a very, very special therapist to do trauma work more intensively. So thank you for everything that you do.
Thank you. And by the way, since we're going to be talking about attachment, I want people who are listening to realize that when I'm talking about trauma therapy, I'm talking about attachment too, because, you know, not having your attachment needs met is a traumatic experience or an adverse experience in childhood. So, you know, oftentimes when people, like you said, they don't recognize that they have trauma because they don't have some major event in their life that they can point to. But as we're talking about attachment today, you know, it's very, I think it's going to become very obvious how, you know, important attachment needs are to our development as humans. So, and you have a wonderful new book, The New Rules of Attachment, How to Heal Your Relationships, Reparent Your Inner Child and Secure Your Life, which I was like, well, that pretty much covers all of it. So I definitely want to hear all about it. But before we get into it, will you just start off by telling our audience a little bit more about who you are and what you do?
Yeah, definitely. So I'm a clinical and forensic neuropsychologist, and I'm also a tenured professor at Pepperdine University. I conduct clinical research. I'm an author, and I have a private practice. And when I wrote my first book, which was Stop Self-Sabotage, I felt like a lot of people felt that that was a very universal concept. That's why I wrote it. I thought that that was universal. But then I was thinking about, you know, what's that next level? You know, what really explains why we self-sabotage? And you have to go all the way back to attachment, because it affects all the different aspects of your life. And so that's what this book is about, is, you know, going back to the origins of where your negative self-talk developed, why these behavioral patterns emerged, and knowing that you can heal any attachment wounds at any age and stage in your life. And it doesn't even necessarily require that the people who might have had, you know, an influence on why your attachment formed the way that it did, it's okay if they're not ready or willing or available to do the work with you. You can do that work on your own and improve all these different aspects of your life.
I love that you said that, because I think sometimes when, even in therapy, I don't know if you've noticed this yourself, but oftentimes when people come in, they have these patterns in their lives or these behaviors that they don't like, or some kind of symptom is affecting them, and they want it to go away, but counseling and therapy don't always address what is causing it. What's the root of this problem? And then when
we get down to attachment, oftentimes people are like, well, my mom's never going to change. So, I mean, what's the point of even talking about this? And it's not, it doesn't, healing doesn't have to mean that the other person changes, right?
Right. Exactly. And I think that, of course, that's what a lot of us feel like needs to happen sometimes for the healing to occur, that the person or persons who've hurt us, they need to recognize that and apologize and make amends and essentially change. But as we all know, we can't change other people. We can only change ourselves. And that can be a hard pill to swallow sometimes, because you're really hoping that that person is going to be there to do that work with you. But oftentimes they're not. And so it's not really about having them live out those expectations. It's about learning to reparent yourself and meeting your own needs in many ways.
Yeah, because, and that's where I think one of the things I wanted to talk to you about was the idea of sort of, you know, some people might call it codependency or codependent relational dynamics, overfunctioning within relationships. I can just think of a classic situation where someone comes to therapy because their partner's not meeting their emotional needs, and all of the conversations in the sessions focus around what that other person is doing or not doing. And the client who's presenting to therapy is feeling very powerless within their relationship. And they're really trying to figure out why the other person's doing all the things they're doing. And, you know, it's really not focusing on themselves. So can you talk about that a little bit, that overfunctioning pattern and how that relates to attachment?
Yeah, definitely. I think that sometimes when we have some unhealed attachment wounds, we end up, you know, basically trying to do the same thing over and over again with people who we maybe have these not so helpful and not so healing relationships with, but we're trying to kind of reenact what happened in the past over and over again, hoping for a different scenario. And so you become really attached in a way to their responses and what they're doing as a way to validate yourself, as a way to feel better. And that pattern makes sense because we're social animals. And so we do need input from other people. We need to derive information from our environment to know a little bit more about ourselves. But when we become overly reliant on someone's reactions to prove something to ourselves, to say that we're okay, to feel good, to have better self-concept, that's when it becomes this more unhealthy pattern where you're constantly expecting and waiting for that person to do something before you can react to it. And so it then leaves you in a state of essentially being more in that passive sort of mind, state of mind, rather than a proactive state of mind of, you know, what can I do, as opposed to, well, what might this person do today? And will that make me feel better or will that upset me?
Yeah. So when the person is not really seeing a problem with their behavior, and we are going, you know, they're doing this, they're doing that, they're doing this, they're doing that, how can someone work with, I guess maybe what would be helpful is, can you talk a little bit more about that reenactment? What are they trying to do over? What are we trying to do over when we show up in therapy like that? I have been that person.
Yeah, I think you're hoping in some ways to try to rewrite your own history, because there's obviously some negative ideas that have developed about who you are and how people are going to respond to you. And by putting yourself inadvertently, it's not always conscious, in the same situation over and over again, you're hoping that something different will emerge that's going to essentially almost be a light bulb moment and say, oh, okay, so my needs do matter after all, or they will take care of me in the way that I want after all. It's a way that your brain is trying to seek healing. But oftentimes, if you're seeking that by reenacting things that have happened in the past, unless that person is completely self-aware and ready to do their own self-development work, that's not really going to be a pattern that will likely emerge. In fact, you'll just end up most likely re-traumatizing yourself or stressing yourself out again, or reinforcing a certain negative idea that these types of reactions in the first place started to formulate for you in your mind. So I think that it makes sense why we would want to try to solve the problem this way, but it's also a usually unproductive one unless the other person is totally ready to do the work too.
Yeah. And in that case, you'd probably already be in couples therapy, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
But the other part of it, I feel, and I wonder what you think about this, is that when, you know, if I'm a partner and I'm saying my partner's doing all these things and my partner's not doing all these things and they just need to change, as my therapist patiently patiently sits with me. It helps me feel like there's something I can control. Like if I can get them to change, then I will have a sense of control. And at the same time, I'm feeling powerless because I can't change them. That's even like maybe a reenactment.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think that sometimes we get into these scenarios where maybe we over-rescue people. We find somebody who might be hurting and we say, okay, I'm going to be the person who gets you to love me or gets you to do something positive in your life. I mean, that's where some of the codependent patterns happen too. Not only because you do truly want to help, you want to help this person, you want to see them do better, but also a part of you gets validation from being able to, like you said, have that sense of control and say, oh, but I could do this. And sometimes it's almost like the bigger the challenge, the more invested you get. Like if the person says, well, I'll never be able to love anyone. I just don't have that capacity. I'm sure you've seen patients like that who are like, oh, like, it's like, you know, white on rice, like they're immediately like gravitate toward that person saying, I'm going to make this person my project. Again, it's not always conscious, but I think part of it is that there is a route to self-esteem that way. You know, if you do see that person changing, you feel great about yourself. But then what happens when they inadvertently have a setback, inadvertently have a bit of a fall, as we all do in our self-development work? Then that person is more likely to blame themselves too and feel overly responsible for that person's outcomes. And I think that that's really difficult.
Yeah. That rescuing thing is so seductive. And I think like culturally reinforced in a lot of ways too.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Like that martyr feeling of, oh, you know, I'm just going to put everybody else's needs before mine. And in some ways, that's admirable. In some ways, that's egocentric in that you get positive feedback about that. And people say, oh, that is so amazing that you're so selfless and you're so helpful. But you burn out. You burn out at work. You burn out in your relationships. You have no time for yourself. And I love the airplane safety briefing analogy of, you know, you have to put your mask on before you, you know, help anybody else around you. If you're not even breathing, how can you do anything else?
Oh, so true. And with that, you know, I often see, I mean, speaking of cultural construction of identity, like we, especially those who are socialized as female, we are encouraged to be helpful and sweet and self-sacrificing and have few needs. And I think it goes through generations that we repeat these patterns. Our mothers were doing these same things, not necessarily by choice, but maybe by lack of choice, you know, just trying to have some way of being an equal partner within a relationship is to do all the caregiving while the other person's doing all the breadwinning, so to speak, back in the day.
Yep. I think so. And I think that these are, you know, just traditions that are passed on, cultural beliefs that are passed on. And even if we think, hey, you know, we're changing our minds about what it really means to be a female, to be a caretaking person, while balancing other things like your career and your other personal needs. I think that the traces of that mother having to be so nurturing and that you're rewarded for being nurturing, it still follows us no matter how, you know, how diverse we feel we have gotten in our perspectives of what it means to be a woman. There's a lot of research that shows, for example, even women who are in supervisory roles, who are managerial roles, who are in executive roles, when they state something in a way that doesn't involve much emotionality, there's a lot of negative labels affixed to those behaviors. But when male leaders utilize those same behaviors, they're thought to be visionaries, they're taught to be great leaders, effective leaders. But when females, you know, use those same behaviors, I mean, really negative terms have come to mind, like this person's a bitch, this person's cold-hearted, right? You hardly ever hear cold-hearted being applied to a male leader. You hear that much more when a female is more authoritative in their day-to-day activity. So I think that still follows us no matter what. And you kind of almost feel like you have to go along a little bit with the cultural constructs in order to fit in.
Yeah. And there's two points I want to make, but the first one's a quick one that, you know, if a male leader is cold-hearted, he would be called a genius, right? Oh, he doesn't know how to be really sensitive. He's just a genius. He's so deep in his thoughts. And women who rise to the upper levels of, you know, C-suite and other leadership positions have had to maybe give up a lot to get to those places. And mm-hmm. then, you know, we're vilified. Not that I'm at those levels, but, you know, they are vilified for not being traditionally feminine enough when they maybe have had to shed a lot of those qualities to survive in the pretty ruthless world, especially of business.
Oh,
business absolutely. And politics.
Right. Exactly. And so I think the expectations are different. How you're thought by other people and what it means to succeed is different. And I think that if you go against, you know, if you're more countercultural in that way, there's definitely going to be some blowback of people making comments about it. And it's just a very interesting dynamic, I think, that, you know, you don't really see being equal across the genders.
That is very true. And wasn't expecting to go in that direction, but I'm glad we did. And at the same time, when we were talking about leadership and women at work and ways of being perceived, I think another big thing that comes up with attachment that I'm curious to hear your take about is workaholism. And that may not be just for women, but how does attachment affect people overworking or being workaholics?
I think that especially when you have avoidant attachment, it's really easy to fall into the trap of overly investing in your personal and professional goals over relationships, because probably in your childhood, you learned some interesting lessons about how people aren't really that dependable, or even learning lessons like, you know, that your self-worth is predicated on how well you're doing. You're the star child of the family. Everything is around, you know, what your achievements are. And so then as you grow older, you hold on to those beliefs and you use them to validate yourself. You use that way to cope when there's too much emotional negativity going on, you know, instead of just sitting there and processing those feelings or trying to cultivate meaningful relationships that are healing, you use work essentially as an escape from these negative thoughts and feelings. Whenever you don't feel good about yourself, you dig right back into work. And of course, that's egocentric as well, similar to when you rescue people or over-rescue people, because it's admirable, especially in our hustle culture of, oh my gosh, you know, you're working so many hours, you're getting so much done. How can I be more like you? You know, you hear these positive messages about being a workaholic, and people usually say they're a workaholic, like with a little bit of pride too, you know? So it's really a different way of trying to interact. But of course, when it is taken to the extreme, it can be really unhealthy, because people who have avoidant attachment will tend to shy away from any kind of emotional conversations. A lot of times they have alexithymia. They have a hard time identifying their own emotions. I've had a lot of patients that I've worked with who come to my practice, and, you know, they know one or two emotion words. Whenever they're upset, it's the same one to two words. They're like, I'm frustrated, or like, I'm upset. It's like, okay, well, tell me more about that. It's like, I don't know. I'm upset. Like, that's how I feel. Because they don't have a feeling of safety when using emotional vocabulary. They fear losing control. And all of us need connection. Even if you identify yourself as a super independent person, you're a lone wolf, but you know, the truth is we're all social animals, and we all need that deeper, meaningful connection with at least a couple of other people in our lives. And so I think the more that you get into this pattern of workaholism, the harder it is to get out, because there is so much, I guess, cultural validation for being a workaholic that's a pattern that's hard to break. It's kind of hard to see why you would want to do that.
My issue with perimenopause was bloating, inflammation. I was also super fatigued and I had a lot of trouble sleeping. Now it's easier to manage menopause with Hormone Harmony. I went to a party last weekend and I couldn't believe how many of the women I was talking to were saying that they were going through perimenopause and had no relief from bloating, gas, hot flashes, mood swings, and just not feeling themselves. And I got it. I told them, I've been there. Hormone Harmony is not just a supplement for women going through
through perimenopause, menopause, or postmenopause. Women can't stop talking about it on social media, and a bottle of Hormone Harmony is sold every 24 seconds. Hormone Harmony contains science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogen. Here's the beauty about adaptogen. They help the body adapt to any stressors like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life. For a limited time, you can get 15% off on your entire first order at happymama.com. Just use the code CHAT at checkout. That's happymama.com and use the code CHAT for 15% off today.
Very true. And it's really rewarded. It's rewarded to be a workaholic because, like you said, we have a productivity-oriented culture, consumerist culture. Everyone has to be working all the time to keep this thing going. And then with the way costs have gone up, it seems like everyone has to work double, triple time to even be able to have the same standard of living they had before, you know, a few years ago. Seems that way to me anyway.
Yeah, definitely. And it's almost like a necessity now, right? So if somebody says, well, hey, can you work a little less, you know, it's like, well, I can't work less. I need to support my family. I need to keep up with my expenses. And they have a point, right? It's really hard to argue against somebody who says that to you. There could be a need. They can also tell themselves that that's the need too. You know, maybe you don't have to work quite as much to make ends meet, but like that's what you've told yourself and that's what makes sense to you to be able to keep these patterns going. And it's interesting how sometimes, and I think that that's what people struggle with when they're trying to change is, well, trying something new, it's so scary. It's the unknown, even if it could lead to more positive outcomes.
Yeah, the familiar pattern might not really be easier, but it seems easier because it's like a go-to.
Right, exactly. And I think that when it feels easier, at least cognitively and emotionally in the moment, that's why it's hard to break those negative patterns because, again, it's familiar to you. So in some ways, it's a little bit less energy just to kind of do the same thing as opposed to saying, like, let me try something new that might actually be helpful to me.
Yeah. When you said lone wolf, I was like, oh, there's my people because I used to really be that way. I just didn't trust people and I didn't, you know, really, I would say you can't count on anyone. You can only count on yourself, you know, and I'm so glad that that has changed for me, that I've felt the really like healing experience of people being there for me when, you know, things were hard. But when the dominant experience that you've had is you were really on your own. And that's sort of, maybe we could talk about that a little bit, how our identity develops around those attachment experiences. Would you be willing to say a little bit about
definitely.
That?
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. You know, I think that many, many times we have our identity creation really in those early days of life where you're just learning how the world works and who you are in it and how people who are your primary caregivers respond when you have a need and you would communicate that need. Tells you a lot about who you are, what your ability is to create change and outcomes in your life. And as you get older, we hold on to pre-existing ideas. We kind of have selective memory so that when we encounter events, interactions with people, we file away the ones that are already consistent with how we feel about ourselves. And the ones that are inconsistent, we kind of like throw away or we explain it differently, unless you take that, you know, thought process out of the automatic drive that it's often in. And so if you grew up with parents and caregivers, adults around you who acted like maybe your needs don't matter that much, or maybe they seemed overwhelmed whenever you communicated a need, it causes you to develop a self-concept of, you know, I need to do things on my own. And whenever I'm struggling, I shouldn't tell anybody because they seem like they just really don't deal well with that, right? So as an adult, you might develop this type of self-concept where you just try to solve all your problems yourself. And whenever you're in stress, you don't reach out to other people. If you had parents who maybe modeled certain coping strategies that felt like they were really fearful of various things in the world, you might grow up, you know, with that same mentality in terms of seeing the world as constantly being in fight or flight. And that's going to affect you know, who you believe you are as well, because you're going to feel like you're constantly in chaos, like you don't have control over your emotions. And it makes it harder to self-actualize. You're kind of always spending time in those basic needs. When you talk about the Maslow hierarchy of needs of, you know, just basic safety and just not really thinking about things like self-esteem or self-actualization or belongingness, you know, you're not going to get to those levels because every day feels a little bit like an uphill battle just trying to survive.
Wow. These are really helpful descriptions. And I just want to point out for people who are listening that it's not like when you're a baby, you think to yourself in these words, my needs are too much for my parents. They're too busy. I don't want to burden them. We don't think that consciously, but it's like our system just senses, don't be too much. Don't cry. Don't, right. You know, it does whatever it does in a beautiful adaptive strategy so that the baby's needs will be met by the caregiver.
Absolutely.
The ones that the caregiver is able to meet.
Right. Yeah. And I think that when we're children, when we're infants, I mean, clearly we can't meet our own needs. And so it's really a difficult and stressful thing when a child notices that their survival is at risk because their caregivers aren't able to or don't want to or are inconsistent in meeting those needs. It puts you in a very precarious place to start with because all of us, you know, we need those early years. We simply can't survive on our own. And so without our caregivers to take care of us, there's not going to be any ability to be able to move through the rest of your life, feeling like you have agency, feeling like you have a strong sense of identity. And so I think that's why those early years are so important. And even if you watch a child grow up, even in those early years, you realize how much they really remember. Obviously, as I think back to my own childhood, I don't remember anything pretty much before the age of 4 or 5. Like I only have really specific memories that I can recall now consciously, you know, after that age. But as I watch my child growing up, I have a toddler who's 2.5 years old. I mean, he remembers things from a year ago.
Yes.
I remember there was a time when he went to the park and he actually saw a child fall from this little fire truck apparatus and hit his head. And the child was crying. It was like a big scene. And every time we go to the park now, and this has been at least a year, whenever he sees that fire truck, he'll go, ouch. And he like pushes his own head. Like he remembers that memory of that child falling. But at that time, he was maybe 14 months, you know? So he has memories from all the way back then. And I was just kind of surprised to see that memory is so specific and it's obviously sticking with him. Even if you don't remember in adulthood, it's still lodged in somewhere in your existence, you know, those types of early memories.
Right. And you know, what you said, he's like, ouch, and he hits his head. It's not like he says, the little boy fell off the fire truck and hit his head and he was crying and his mommy picked him up. But his system knows someone got hurt. That was the thing that caused it.
Right.
And if he grows up when he's 25 and he has a phobia about fire trucks, she'll know why.
Now you'll know why. Oh, yeah. He absolutely refuses to play on the fire truck for that reason. I'll be like, you want to go play on the fire truck? Be like, no. And he just like starts walking in a different direction.
He's like, mom, come on. What do I look like? I saw what happened with that thing.
Exactly. What are you trying to do to me?
This is such an example of how when we become parents or, you know, for those who don't become parents, but we're around little kids, toddlers and babies, we see what we can't remember from our own childhoods. You know, I thought, and I'm sure that my parents said this to me at least a couple times growing up or as an adult, that kids don't remember their childhoods. So when I had kids and I saw that they weren't just like blobs that had no feelings or thoughts, they were taking in everything that was happening all the time and reacting to things and feeling things. And for one thing, I noticed that my son and my daughter were no different in having crying when they were scared, you know, both got angry and screamed and yelled and threw things. It wasn't a gender specific thing. But then we have these like cultural constructs that influence the way we see the world as we develop that change kind of what's our innate knowing, I think.
Right.
It's like we gaslight. It's not us gaslighting ourselves. It's culture gaslighting us. But then we, you know, we have this, it's like this cognitive dissonance about, you know, this is what I know inside, but then there's what I'm told and how I'm supposed to be.
Yeah, exactly.
once you see little kids, you know, I think it gives, for me, that was the biggest change to my attachment development, I think, as an adult, was to become a parent and just see, wow, I was just a little kid when these things happened. Exactly. Or when I was trying to cope with these huge experiences that I just didn't know what to do with.
Right.
You see how small they are.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that there's no learning like you said, like being around little kids, like having your own kids. There's one level of that work that you do as a professional. And then there's what you see in your personal life and how you see them develop on a day-to-day basis and how they absorb information from the world and what they do with that information. And like, that's a completely different type of learning, even for myself, you know? So I really felt like that was a huge, just again, like a huge, I would say it's like a huge part of how I learned more about maybe how babies' minds really work. You know, it's just watching my son every day and seeing kind of how he absorbs information and how he takes it in and how it like lodges in his memory. Even like you said, if you can't spell it out in the same way, you know, be verbally articulate about it because that's not really his developmental phase, but it's there. All that information is there and he's learned from it.
Right. Well, I know we don't have a lot of time left, but in the time we have, can we talk a little bit, or will you talk a little bit about how listeners can heal their inner child and their, you know, and what does healing your inner child have to do with attachment? You know, how are they connected?
Yeah. Inner child work is so important because all of us have a version of our metaphorical little child that still lives with us with, you know, possibly unhealed wounds and unmet needs and desires and goals and how they felt like their life was going to turn out. And as an adult, oftentimes we tuck that inner child away because we don't know how much they're going to be well received if we really allow them to come out. But, you know, it comes out anyway, because whenever we're really stressed out, I mean, that's why regression as a coping mechanism exists. It's like that inner child is crying and saying, I need help. I need someone to say that what I'm feeling is okay. But it can be really, really tough to realize that as an adult, you have the capacity to heal your inner child and you don't really need anyone else's help as long as you can recognize and honor the feelings of your inner child and then be able to address them. And the reason why reparenting work is so important is because as an adult, you have many more tools. You have much more self-agency than you had at a younger age. And you can provide your child with the care and the love that they needed from back then and essentially begin to reparent them through attaching to yourself, having a secure development, secure relationship with yourself, having that secure attachment from your inner child to your inner parent. And reparenting work involves, you know, a few different types of things, but it's really just about making sure that you're prioritizing the things that you know you need to feel good about yourself as you move forward in life. And so some more specific examples of that would be just not having self-blame and having more self-compassion whenever you make a mistake or do something you wish you didn't do, or identifying your boundaries and then holding those boundaries without feeling guilt, acknowledging to yourself that you have worth no matter what happens, that you are unconditionally worthy just by being you, just by being a person. It's not tied to how many people you rescue or how many achievements you have in a day. And reparenting can just be about intentional self-care and knowing that that's a priority. So it doesn't have to be this huge amorphous thing. There's also deeper things that you can do to reparent. You can do visualizations. That's one of my favorite ways to access the inner child, where you visualize your adult self having a conversation with your child self and reassuring them and giving them advice, right? In that way, you're actually kind of honing your intuition and being able to understand a little bit of like what's most important to you in life and how to get it. But it can just be in these smaller intentional acts too, where every day you're living by your top two or three values. If you know something's important to you, making sure that your life is still moving in that direction. You know, it really is all about just honoring your individual needs without apologizing.
I love how succinctly you were able to describe that. And I think for a lot of people, that paragraph that you just said will be something that they'll be like, oh my gosh, wow, I'm going to get started now. But I also know that from experience, both personal and professional, I know that it's sometimes easy to reject our inner child. as we may have been rejected. So do you have any guidance for people who bump up against that when they try to do inner child work?
Yeah, that's such a good question. And I think that it can be sort of hard to affirm yourself when you feel like you haven't been affirmed in the past. Like maybe you're used to rejecting your inner child or thinking that their needs don't matter because other people modeled that for you at some point. And I think what really helps is really just picturing, it doesn't even have to be you as a baby, but just picturing a baby in your life, or like any baby, any human baby, any mammal baby, really. And just remembering how helpless we all are when we come into this world, and that really the baby is not at fault. The baby is innocent, you know, and all it's trying to do is like find a way to survive. And so if you can sort of make that analogy and like really visualize that and bring that to the fore, it's like, you know, who would reject like such an innocent being that is just trying to find out how the world works? Like all of its intentions are innocent, and it's just trying to survive in this world that they were born into. And so I think sometimes as a child, when we start to attribute too much intention to a child, or, oh, this is a bad behavior, and sometimes you have gotten those messages, that's when you start to reject it. But if you can just picture your inner child at like the most basic level of like being a completely, you know, helpless, innocent baby, it's going to be a lot harder to reject the needs of that particular being. And if you can't picture yourself as a baby, then picture like an innocent little animal as a baby, or like another baby in your life, you know, where you kind of just see that innocence, like they're just trying their best to communicate their needs. And maybe they're not always doing it in the most effective way because they just don't have the tools, but all of their needs and desires are innocent.
Oh, that's so beautiful. I love that. Thank you. And yeah, I feel like, and if you can't, you know, think of an animal that you love, like even a cartoon character or something, even a picture of something that you can feel love for, connection, is a start to say, how could this being deserve to be mistreated or rejected? They just want to be safe.
Right. They just want to be safe. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, Judy, this has been a beautiful conversation. I loved talking with you. And will you tell our listeners where they can find your book and all the amazing things that you're doing?
Oh, thank you so much. Well, you can find me on my website, drjudyho.com. I have a lot of free resources there. You can also sign up for my newsletter where I give out a lot of my free resources and advice through there as well. And you can follow me on social media at Dr. Judy Ho.
Wonderful. I will share all of these in the show notes. And thank you so much for being my guest today.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been such a wonderful conversation. I really appreciate you.
Try Therapy Notes, the number one rated electronic health record system, available today. With live telephone support 7 days a week, it's clear why Therapy Notes is rated 4.9 out of 5 stars on Trustpilot and has a 5-star rating on Google. Therapy Notes makes billing, scheduling, note-taking, and telehealth incredibly easy. And now for all you prescribers out there, Therapy Notes is proudly introducing ePrescribe. Try it today with no strings attached and see why everyone is switching to Therapy Notes, now featuring ePrescribe. You can get 2 months free by using promo code CHAT at therapynotes.com. Trauma Therapist Network is a website to learn about trauma and how it shows up in our lives and to find a trauma therapist. Go to traumatherapistnetwork.com to find a trauma therapist near you today.
Thank you for listening to Therapy Chat with your host, Laura Reagan, LCSWC. For more information, please visit therapychatpodcast.com.